All right. Friends, we love, I think, stories of self-made men. We love stories of self-made men. And what do I mean by that? Well, Benjamin Franklin, take him. He was the 15th of 17 children. He ran away when he was 17, had basically nothing to his name, and yet, to quote from his own autobiography, through sheer industry and sheer ingenuity, he built himself into a world-leading scientist, an international diplomat and statesman, and a wealthy businessman. Or you could take, for example, Frederick Douglass, born into slavery with no legal right even to his own body. He would rise to become himself a world-renowned orator. Take Abraham Lincoln, grew up in a single-room log cabin, had but one formal year of education, worked on rail lines, worked as a clerk, and eventually became the president of the United States. But friends, we can even look closer to home, right? Many of us know the story of Sam Walton, grew up in rural Missouri, right? During the Great Depression, had to work his way through college, and from a single Ben Franklin variety store, right, he turned that into the world's largest retailer. Or you take John Tyson, who started Holland Chickens around Northwest Arkansas before he and his son scaled it to become one of the largest meat producers in the world. Or you can take J.B. Hunt, who started with just a few trucks, and he scaled that. J.B. Hunt Transportation Services. Now it's not only one of the largest transportation companies in the U.S., I read it's the largest leader in intermodal freight. And I think I know what that means. Someone can explain it later if I'm off, all right? Point being, right, it can be chickens in Springdale, it can be trucks in Lowell, it can be stores in Bentonville. Some of the best self-made stories in America didn't start on Wall Street, they started in small-town Arkansas. And we celebrate that, right? We love that. We love the stories of self-made men, those who by grit and by sheer determination and force of will seem to overcome every single obstacle and they rise to the top. And we have those compelling examples. We have them financially. We have them politically. But friends, does that same approach, does it work spiritually? Does it work spiritually? Is the key to your own spiritual growth, the key to your access with God, friends, is that all about self-reliance? Is that all about self-dependence? Is that all about self-sufficiency? Is the key to your spiritual success believing and trusting in yourself? Or might it be coming, in fact, to the end of oneself? Might it be actually coming to the end of oneself that we actually find our way to God? Well, friends, for that, I want us to turn back in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 11. If you would turn back in your Bibles to Genesis 11, we're going to be in the whole chapter. You can find it, I think, on page 8 of those red pew Bibles that are in the seat backs before you. And if you're just joining us, Genesis, again, is a book about beginnings, about how God created the world and then how man corrupted that world. And then God consumed that world in a flood, and then God recreated the world, and Noah was meant to repopulate it, just as Adam and Eve had done, only he and his sons lead that world into corruption once again. And so this morning, we actually find ourselves at the end of this first section of Genesis, sort of the end of these new beginnings in Genesis 1 to 11. And the question that has been lingering in the background of Genesis 1 to 11 that's going to continue to linger as we read through the Bible is there a way back to God? How do we get back to Eden? How do we get back to that garden? Is there a path back to Eden and to heaven? And if so, is that path found, to quote Franklin again, through sheer industry and ingenuity? Well, friend, if not, how is it found? Well, it's here from Genesis chapter 11. Follow along as I read. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people. They all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing they propose to do will now be impossible with them. So come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. And so the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. These are the generations of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he fathered Arpachshad 500 years and had other sons and daughters. And when Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he fathered Shelah. And Arpachshad lived after he fathered Shelah 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he fathered Eber. And Shelah lived after he fathered Eber 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Eber had lived 34 years, he fathered Peleg. And Eber lived after he fathered Peleg 430 years and had other sons and daughters. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he fathered Reu. And Peleg lived after he fathered Reu 209 years and had other sons and daughters. When Reu had lived 32 years, he fathered Serug. And Reu lived after he fathered Serug 207 years and had other sons and daughters. When Serug had lived 30 years, he fathered Nahor. And Serug lived after he fathered Nahor 200 years and had other sons and daughters. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he fathered Terah. And Nahor lived after he fathered Terah 119 years and had other sons and daughters. When Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah and the land of his kindred, Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. All right, so I put that question back out. Is there a way back to God, to Eden, to heaven? Well, I think we see there is a way, but it's not perhaps the way we might expect or think. And I think this is the lesson from Genesis 11. Don't trust your performance to get to heaven. Trust in God's promise. Don't trust your performance to get to heaven. Instead, trust God's promise. And the story of Babel will really function as sort of a lesson of where not to place our trust. And that will be point one, right? Don't trust your performance. And then interestingly, with the genealogies, they're gonna provide for us the proper source of our trust. And those genealogies will help us see that our trust is to be secondly in God's promises. Trust God's promises. So point one first, don't trust in your performance. Point one, don't trust in your performance. Now, as we drop into chapter 11, we read in verse 1 that the whole earth had one language and the same words. Or as the CSB reads, the same language and the same vocabulary. That's the idea of same words. They had a shared vocabulary. And so what we've just done is we've actually jumped back in time. We've jumped back in time. Recall, chapter 10 tells us where all the people scattered. But here in chapter 11, the beginning of chapter 11, we read of why they scattered. So Genesis 11 is really the cause of the scattering, what led to the scattering. It was Genesis 10 that was actually the effect of it. And so again, we've sort of jumped back in time to explain why Genesis 10 happened the way it did. But again, the scene opens and the people, they're packing up their tents and they're actually migrating eastward. And they settle in Shinar. You could say it's in Mesopotamia. It's a fertile valley right between the Tigris and Euphrates River. And they settle there. And there, what do? Verse 3, they invent brick making. And they build themselves a city. Now, if we've been paying attention throughout the book of Genesis, these little details should give us pause. Because in Genesis, eastward is the direction that Adam and Eve headed when they were exiled out of the garden. And if you remember Cain, when Cain was condemned to wander the earth, where did he head? But he headed east. Later, in the story with Abraham and Lot, when Lot is going to choose his land, he's going to choose land to the east in Sodom. In Genesis, friends, east is where hope goes to die, and east is where ambition turns to ash. And building a city, right, this fascination with technology, does that remind you of Cain and all of Cain's descendants back in Genesis chapter 4? Right, all these little details are helping us see that all this work and this people there in Babel, well, they're following and they're really spiritual descendants of that condemned line of Cain. They're the spiritual heirs of the seed of the serpent. They are not part of the seed of promise. And that explains in part why, what do? They build themselves a tower with its top in the heavens. Now, friends, this was no ordinary tower. So I know we've got some homeschoolers out there, all right? So homeschoolers, this is when you dial in right now. Maybe some of you have been to classical school. I'm gonna call on you, and I want you to tell me, raise your hand if you would. You don't have to tell me exactly. Just raise your hand if you know what a ziggurat is, all right? If you know what a ziggurat is, all right? Now, come on, homeschoolers. Like, be proud. This is your moment, all right? A ziggurat. Anyone know? Okay, I see a few hands. I'm not asking you public school kids because I didn't learn this in public schools. Maybe they do better in Arkansas than California. I don't know. But this isn't the kind of stuff I was taught in public school. But a ziggurat, okay, what is it? Well, I trust you can explain this to the rest of us, but I think we have a picture. Look at that. I know, this is like 3 weeks in a row. I don't know what's happening, but here it is. Like, we got a little slide. We got this picture. This is the famous ziggurat, the great ziggurat of Ur. And what is it? Well, It's really just a tower, so to speak, that's in the shape of a mountain that has these staircases that's meant to lead up into the heavens. And so these ziggurats were literally considered stairways to the heavens. And it's how the ancients would ascend to heaven and they would meet with the gods and how the gods might descend and meet with them. And you see that right in the name Babel, because that word Babel in Akkadian, it means the gate of the gods. And so they're building a literal stairway to heaven, the gate of the gods. And why do they build it? Verse 4. Well, we're told because they want to make a name for themselves and they don't want to be dispersed from all over the earth. Now, remember back in Genesis 1, but particularly Jack in Genesis 9, verse 1, God had commanded Noah and his sons, just like he commanded Adam and Eve, to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And he's told them how they can make a great name for themselves, so to speak. If you recall Shem, that descendant, Shem, that word just means name. And if they want a great name, what are they to do? Well, they're to align, they're to unite themselves with the line of Shem. They're to dwell in the tents of Shem, in the house of Shem, in the line of promise. That is how one makes a great name. God has made that clear, but they're not interested in that path. They're not pursuing that path, right? They have their own plans. They have their own ideas of how they're going to get back to God. And friends, right here in Genesis 11, we are right back in Genesis chapter 3. We're right back to Adam and Eve in the garden. Those who sought to gain access to God, even become like God, not on God's terms, but on their own terms. And friends, we're seeing right here once again the heart of sin. We're seeing the heart of sin at work. And the risk for some of us is that we'll think of sin simply as those bad things that we do. Those embarrassing things, right? Those scandalous things that show up in the news. But friends, sin is much more than that. Sin runs a lot deeper than that. Because sin at its heart rejects our status. At its heart, when we sin, we reject our status as creatures. And what do? We demand ourselves to be creator. Sin seeks to dethrone God as the ruler over our life and place ourselves instead on that throne. Right? Sin is fundamentally wanting to live life our way, right? On our own terms, where we get to call the shots and where we get to run the show. And that is what sin is. And at the heart of every sin, thus, is the refusal to let God be God. And that should unsettle, I think, some of us. It ought to unsettle us. Because for some of us, we're like, yeah, I'm faithful to my spouse. I don't lie on my taxes. I'm diligent at work. I don't rob banks. I don't deal drugs. I don't kick the neighbor's dog when it's ornery. Like, whatever it is. And we take comfort because those things are not true of us. And so we assume that we're good. But Genesis 11 is helping us see that actually entirely misses the point. Because all those good things, so to speak, that we might do, all those things, if those things are in the exercise of making someone else's name great other than God's, namely making our name great other than God's, then friend, that is sin because we're doing it for us and not for him. Friends, how often do you do the right thing only because you know someone is looking? You know, we think like, we know kids do that when they're really young. We never grow out of it, sadly. How often do we just do the right thing when we think someone's looking? How often do we only say the right thing or not say the wrong thing because we think someone else is listening? Right? How often do we're like, yeah, sure, I'll pick up the trash in my neighbor's yard because guess what? They're sitting on the porch. Probably be a nice thing to do. But if there's no neighbor on the porch, do we pick up the trash? Sin is not just about doing wrong things. Sin can also be about doing right things, but for all the wrong reasons. To make our name great and to make ourselves look good. And that too is sin, and that is a heart of pride. And friends, that's been our problem since the fall. We make much of us and we make little of God, and we do it all the time. So just think about your life for a moment. Think about your direction. Think about the things you value, what you choose to pursue. In all of those things, is your overarching goal, your singular aim to make God's name great? Is that why you do it? Or embedded in there, is there a strong desire, maybe even a principal desire, that you would make your name great? Friends, who's reputation do you instinctively protect first? Do you protect God's reputation first? Or do you seek to protect your own reputation first? You know, I've maybe used this illustration before, but one of my favorite movies is The Miracle. It's the story of the 1980 U.S. hockey team, right, going up against the Soviets, undefeated. We got a bunch of young kids, and they're training, and they're not gelling together as a team, and the coach is getting exasperated, and he keeps trying to press home a point. And finally, they get it, that the name on the front of the jersey is way more important than the name on the back of the jersey. And it's just the same with us. Right? When we rep Jesus, the name Jesus is what is of principal importance. Our name takes a back seat. It's at the back of the jersey. Jesus must come first in everything. That's why, friends, we care at UBC so much about God's name. Because what does God do with God's name? He ties it to local people, to local gatherings, congregations, churches like UBC. Which is why we care about who bears that name in membership. It's why we care about who might forfeit that name through their sin unrepentantly in discipline. It's why we care about how we expand that name in evangelism. It's why we care about how we strengthen that name in our discipling with one another. And one of the ways that we make a name for ourselves, if we're not careful, and many do it, is they seek to construct their own way back to God, right? On our terms, by our means. Because when we do that, the path to heaven and the way to heaven finally rests on us and what we can do, and we don't have to finally be dependent upon God. And that's what's happening in Genesis 11, right? They're going to rely on their own ingenuity, right? Brick making. It's interesting, when you get to the Lord's temple later, the Lord's temple is not made by things that are made by human hands, right? It's what he makes. It's stone and things like that. It's not man-made brick, at any rate, aside. But they're going to rely on their own ingenuity, their own brick making, their own industry, right? Hard work. They're going to build this tower, and they're going to find a way back to God. They are seeking to be spiritually self-made men. And if we're not careful, we'll do the same. We'll assume that if we do just enough to please God, just enough to impress God, then we can get back to God. Right? If we just start going to church a little bit more regularly, if we would just give a little bit more faithfully, if we would just maybe engage in a few acts of charity, if we would maybe love others more faithfully, if we would live more sacrificially, right? If we would just like find that vice, one of those vices, and we're like, yeah, I'm gonna put that to death. I'm gonna be more diligent about that. Whatever it is, we can think that if we just take each one of those things and take them and we lay them down like bricks, one on top of another, and we lay them down and we stockpile them one on top of the other. And what do we think we do? Well, we think we can construct our own ziggurat of good works and we can make our way back to God. And friends, that's how religion works. And that's how the human heart tends to work. We think we can make our way back to God. But friends, what does God think? What does he think about this religious building project they're engaged in? Can we become spiritually self-made men? Right, look down to verse 5. What do we read? And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. Now, this is what you call anthropomorphic language. It's when language that is usually used to describe human beings is to describe someone that is not a human being. In this case, God the divine. Right? God is spirit. God doesn't have a body. So he doesn't like travel through space in the same way. He doesn't have eyes that he needs to see. And there's a good bit of sarcasm. I hope you didn't miss it here in our passage. Because the people are taking great pride in this tower that they say is going to reach to the heavens. And God's like, where is it? Like he's putting his hands over his eyes. He's like, you guys, there's some tower to the heavens. I'm looking. I can't see this thing anywhere. I better come down a little further, right? Maybe I'm just a little too high. I'll come down a little lower. Maybe I'll find it and I'll see it if I come down a little. Hey, guess what? Guys, where's this tower? I don't see it. Where is it? No, the tower is so puny, God has to keep coming down to see it. Closer and closer. He's like, I'll find like, oh yeah, there it is. That little tiny lump. All right, it's right down there. And it's easy to read verse 6 like God is threatened by this project. Right, if we don't stop them now, like something terrible's gonna happen and nothing will be impossible for them. It's kind of like us with Iran's nuclear program. Like, if we don't stop it right now, who knows what's gonna happen? Like, I gotta act. Well, that's not verse 6. That's not how God is behaving. No, there's just more sarcasm. God's not threatened by this. God has nothing to fear from this project. He can barely make out this project. Right, we were flying late last night at like 36,000 feet. And just, I was thinking to myself, yeah, that ziggurat was like 50 feet off the ground, like to the heavens. Oh my word, what a joke. Well, God's not fearing this project. After they are children of man, verse 5. Right? They're mere mortals. And yet for their rebellion, and so that the world doesn't return to the kind of wickedness of Genesis chapter 6, God is still going to judge them. And so notice, just as the people leveraged this gift of language against God, So what's God going to do? God is actually going to confuse their language. He's going to turn their language against them. And in Hebrew, Babel, as you see at the bottom, literally means confused. It's kind of where we get our English word babbling, right? When someone just rambles on and on, blah, blah, blah. Like, what are they doing? They're just babbling, right? It's just a bunch of nonsense. That's the sense here. And notice they didn't want to disperse and fill the earth. They wanted to gather in one place. And so in judgment, God is going to scatter and disperse them across the earth. As we've seen in Genesis, the punishment always fits the crime. And their massive construction project is left unfinished. An abandoned structure, right? Bricks and construction materials strewn across the ground. Right? It's all collecting dust. It's haunting the landscape. I remember years ago, the first time I went to the UAE, we were driving out of Dubai to Ras Al Khaimah, and we were heading down, and you're just in the desert in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden out of the middle of nowhere in this desert rise like 6 or 8 massive skyscrapers. Massive. There were like 50 stories. That's not really massive. Not when you have the like Burj Dubai, but at any rate. But they were big. They were big buildings in the middle of nowhere, just rising up into the sky. 50, 80, I don't know, stories. And there were 7, 8, 9 of them. But what was amazing is there was nothing there. They rose up. They had no windows. They were like these haunting like skeletons of buildings that were clearly built at some point partially and then just abandoned. And as I was thinking about the story, I was thinking about those buildings because that's what it must have looked like as the people abandoned this ziggurat and they left. Now you have this half-constructed tower to the skies and it's just haunting the landscape. Nothing is going to happen to it. And this is just a perfect picture of what we read in Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. And so in the Bible, what we're going to find is that Babylon becomes a kind of prototype for all the nations and all the peoples that in their pride would seek to rise up against God. But friends, the point that we need to take from this is that we can pile all of our good works and we can seek to pile them as high as the heavens. But if we trust in them and if we rest in them and if we seek to actually place any weight and stand upon them like a house of cards, they will come crashing down. They cannot bear the weight. And in 11:9, we're right back to where we were in Genesis 4. A people like Cain, wandering the earth without hope and without God. So if we're not to trust in our performance, what are we to trust in? Well, friend, that brings us to point 2, trust in God's promise. Trust in God's promise. And as we get further into Genesis chapter 11, what do we find in verse 10? But we find another genealogy. And not just one genealogy, we actually have 2 genealogies. And the first runs from 11:10 all the way through 11:26. And it's going to trace the generations of Shem. And if that generation of that genealogy sounded at all familiar, it's because that genealogy in 11:10-26 is very similar to the genealogy we read back in chapter 5, right? Where we read that so-and-so lived X years and they fathered so-and-so and then, you know, they lived so many years and they had many sons and daughters, you know, and then they died. And then they died, right? That was sort of what we saw in Genesis chapter 5. Well, it's similar here, right? They're both linear genealogies. They just traced one line. And both of these genealogies in Genesis 5 and in Genesis 11, verses 10-26, they actually constitute both of them 10 generations. Both are 10 generations. So Genesis 5 had 10 generations from Adam and Noah. Genesis 11 here has 10 generations from Shem to Terah. Both are selective genealogies. They're not exhaustive. Both end with a descendant that has 3 sons. So Genesis 5 ended with Noah, right? And he had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Genesis 11:26 ends with Terah, who is what? Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. And in both those genealogies, the 7th person in the genealogy is especially important. Remember back in Genesis 5, that 7th person was who? It was Enoch. Remember the one who walked with God. Well, who's the 7th in this one? The 7th in this one is going to be Eber, Remember, that's where we get our word Hebrew. We thought about that last week. And it's at Eber that the line divides. Remember, he's got two sons. You got Joktan and you got Peleg that come out of Eber. And we looked at Joktan's line last week. And that line at the end of Genesis chapter 10, remember where Joktan's line leads us? Joktan's line leads us right into the Tower of Babel, right there. So in other words, don't look to Joktan's line. There's no hope in that line. Okay, but it split at Eber. There was Joktan. Who's the other one? Well, there's Peleg. Ha, guess what? That's what we pick up here. We get Peleg's line on this one. And this is the line, verse 18, the line of promise that continues. And as you follow it down past verse 18, it finally leads to Terah. And then we read in verse 26, Abram. The first time we've come across his name yet in Genesis. Abram, the great patriarch, who's going to now dominate chapters 12 through 25, and through whom all the nations of the earth would be blessed. But did you notice here in Genesis 11, there's not the repeated, and he died, and he died, and he died. And so there's a sense of hope as we're tracing this line, which is appropriate. And though the ages are decreasing, right, Shem lives 600 years or so, Nahor drops only to like 148, it feels like the section is almost accelerating, like it's moving somewhere, excitedly, quickly, fast. And remember back in Genesis 3, God promised that there would be one who would crush the head of the serpent. And we've been waiting for that promise to be fulfilled, and we were wondering, right, would it be Abel? Or maybe would it be Seth, or would it be Noah, or is it going to be Shem? Well, it's not Shem, it's those who dwell in the tents. Okay, like, who's it going to be? And now we're wondering and we're waiting. And then it divides at Peleg. Remember, his name means divide. Again, Joktan takes us to Babel, don't want to go there. Peleg, where does Peleg lead? To Terah. And just like that, all of a sudden the chapter, these are the generations of, right, that ends. 17 verses. That's that whole section, 17 verses, that's it. But what's happened? Our attention has been turned what? To the line of promise. It's been turned to the line of promise. And we're tracing that promise. And what are we seeing? God's promises are alive and well. God is going to keep his promise, right? There's hope. There is still hope that this one, this serpent crusher, is going to come. And then we turn to a new chapter. And we get another genealogy, verse 27. Right? These are the generations of. Remember, that's sort of like the chapters in Genesis. These are the generations of. In this case, generations of Terah. And what do we read? Well, like Noah, what does Terah have? Terah has three sons. And just like Noah, right? We read about the sons and their wives, just as we read it with Noah. And like Noah, they're going to embark on the significant journey. They're going to head to a new land. They're going to go to Canaan, a kind of Eden. And so the excitement is building. As we keep reading, we're getting excited. We're thinking, this is it. Like, maybe now, finally, the promise is going to be fulfilled. Here we go. And we're on the edge of our seats. And yet, as we get into those last verses, what happens? But everything, everything comes crashing down. The proverbial record skips. Because what do we read in verse 28? But tragedy strikes. One of Terah's children, Haran, has died. And not just died, but we read died in the presence of his father. There are few things, friends, in life harder than outliving one of your own children. The kind of grief that that pain brings, to watch them die, to lower them in the ground, that is soul-crushing grief. And then we're given the names of two wives. And we're told about Sarai, we're told about Milcah. But you know, in Akkadian, Sarai means, well, it's the wife. Sarai is the name of the wife of the moon god. And Milcah is the name of the daughter of the moon god. And we're like, okay, what's this about? And then we read this journey to Canaan. What happens? It peters out. It stalls out. Where does it stall out? In Haran. And Terah is going to settle in Haran. And what's Haran it's famous for? It's famous for its moon worship. And we get the sense something, once again, is desperately not right. Terah seems to be worshiping other gods, something that Joshua 24:2 makes very clear. And so Terah worships the moon god. Now they're stuck in Haran, this land of moon worship, right? One son is dead and he is left to orphans. The other son, Nahor, is going to stay there in Haran like his father. And the other son, Abram, well, okay, all right, we look to him and Abram's married. But the woman he's married to, verse 30, oh, she's barren. And just to drive the point home, as if we needed it driven home, we're told she had no child. And just like that, the promise line and the anticipation and the expectation that was building through chapter 11, it again comes crashing into a screeching halt, right? Headlong into a brick wall. This is a terrible dead end we have just hit. Because all eyes are now on Abram and Sarai. But how can the promised seed possibly come through a barren couple? And that's the burning question. And that's what Genesis 12 to 25 is going to be all about. Because we're about to see how God will regularly use barrenness in the Bible as a kind of training ground for faith. Barrenness in the Bible is actually but the beginning of something much bigger and something much greater. It's going to be true for Sarai. It's going to be true for Rebecca. It's going to be true for Rachel. It's going to be true for Hannah. It's going to be true for Elizabeth as we get to Luke. Right? I could just keep going. Because it's exactly in our inability that God's ability shines brightest. In the words of Jesus, with man, this is impossible, but with God, what? All things are possible. And this is where the story is pushing us. Right? It's pushing us not to trust in our performance, but instead to trust in God's promise. To trust in God's promise. Even when that promise looks cooked, and it looks cooked at this point, even when that promise looks cold and dead in the grave, God can raise it up to newness of life. And yet it's so easy to trust our performance, to trust our own resources. And we're going to see Abram's going to do this. He's going to trust his own performance. And at some point he's going to say, like, Sarah, I've kind of given up on you. I'm going to get another wife, right? He's going to trust wrongly in such things. But Genesis 11 is looking and pushing us to trust the promise. Because friends, it's what Eve did. She didn't trust the promise. Do you remember when she first conceived? Do you remember how I noted those words, her words? I have gotten a man. Emphasis on I, what she's done, how she's bringing this about, or Cain and Nimrod with all their cities and with all their technology, or Babel and Babel's gate to the gods, even Noah's vineyard and the way he's seeking to kind of plant a new Eden. It is so easy in the Christian life to trust our own resources, our own abilities, our own performance. We think that we can, in doing so, help further and bring about God's plans. And so what do? We gut it out. And friends, sometimes the only way we learn is when God brings us to an utter end of ourselves. He brings us to the end of ourselves and the end of our own abilities into circumstances that we can't possibly fix, into situations we just can't control. Right? It's all beyond us. It is too much for us. And we're prone to sink further into despair. And we often see those moments as moments of cruelty. When so often, in fact, they're moments of God's mercy. Friends, sometimes God will bring you and he'll bring me to the utter end of ourselves in order to teach us that we're not to trust in ourselves. But to trust in him, to look to him, to depend upon him. How will it be, how could it possibly be that a barren couple at their age could possibly have descendants more numerous than the sand on the sea or the stars in the sky? We're about to find out. But friends, that will only come by faith. That will only come by faith. As exhibited in Abraham, as we'll see, the man of faith. And UBC, that's what God is calling us to. That's what God is calling us to walk by faith, not by sight. to trust unswervingly in his promises and not to trust in our own performance, to believe that what is impossible for us is not impossible for God, to know and to know at the bottom of our own souls that no matter how bad things get, no matter how awful they might appear, God will fulfill his promises for his people, and that means us too. He will not leave us. He will not forsake us. One way or another, he will accomplish his good purposes in and through us, and he'll do it together because that's what God does. And sometimes he'll bring us to the end of ourselves in order that we will see that it is him and it is his work, that we might make his name great and not our own. Because the line, right, of the promised seed is not going to end. It's not going to die with Abram. If you know the storyline of the Bible, Abraham and Sarah, they would bear children by a kind of supernatural life that was only possible by trusting in God's promises, by believing in his word. And when they did that, God did what they did not think was possible and everyone thought was laughable. But that's what God loves to do. That's what he loves to do. And then out of them would what? Spring a great nation. And though enslaved in Egypt, God would deliver that nation. And this place of Canaan that Abraham was headed, well, God will bring his people there and they will settle there. And then if sadly, if you know the story, what do? They rebel. And so just like those in early Genesis 11, when they rebel, what does God do? He scatters them amongst the nations, just like at Babel. And if there was to be any hope for Israel, if there is to be any hope for us, it's not going to be means of our own performance. It's not going to be by constructing our own ziggurats, right, of good works, things reaching up to the heavens. That's not going to be the means. No, God would have to come down again. And the same way he came down in Genesis 11, he would have to come down again. He would have to condescend. And he would do so in the person of Jesus Christ. He would condescend in Jesus Christ. As Jesus would say in John 1:51, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened. Right? You're going to see the staircase and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. What is he saying? He's saying, I'm the gate. I am that stairway. And there was no one else other than me. I am the way to God. And how did he secure that way to God for us? By living the life we were meant to live. By dying the death that each one of us deserves to die. And then he rose from the grave and he ascended into heaven so that all would turn from their sin and all that would trust in him would one day be taken up to heaven with him. He would come down again and bring them back to be with him. And that's where the Bible is going. That's where it takes us. And that's the hope of Christianity. Friend, if you have come and you're not a Christian, you're not a believer in Jesus Christ, the message of Christianity is not try harder. It is simply to trust. Now, that's not as easy as it sounds, as we see with Abraham and Sarah, as we know in our own lives, but it is what he calls us to do, to trust that Jesus alone can save, to trust that he saves, and that through his life, death, and resurrection, Jesus can do for you what you cannot do for yourself because he has paid the wages of your sin. He has made the way back to God, and you will only find it by trusting and believing in him. And friends, for those of us who do believe, right, who are believers, the curse of Babel that we see, well, we read earlier where that curse is reversed, right? It's reversed at Pentecost. It's reversed there in Acts chapter 2. When the nations that were scattered with multiple tongues, they're gathered back there in Jerusalem, and they each hear the gospel, the word preached, what? In their own tongue. They hear it in their own tongue. And so what happens? So they're saved and what? And they're sent back out into the nations to preach that gospel so that others might hear and believe. And that's what we're called to do together as a congregation. We're called to sit under the preached word together. We're called to be transformed by that word corporately like we are now in another context. We're called to be transformed by that word individually as we meet with one another, care for one another, pray for one another, minister the word of God to one another. And then we take that word, proclaiming Christ from all the scriptures to make disciples from all the nations. But we're not in the promised land yet. We're still not there, right? Abram wasn't there. We are not there. And we don't give up and we don't pitch our tent halfway there like Terah. Like this is close enough. This is good enough. No, we don't do that. Revelation 17 and 18, you want to know where those spiritual descendants of Babylon, where do they land? Go read Revelation 17 and 18 and it's not pretty. Don't give up. Don't pitch your tent in this world and follow the ways of this world. No, like Abraham in Hebrews 11, 10, we look forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect, designer, and builder is God. Right? We don't live to make much of our name. For our glory is knowing that our names are written in the Lamb's book of life. In that book. And there is no greater blessing than being united to him and to be found in him. Friend, I want you to see there's no such thing. No such thing as being a self-made Christian. There are two lines and two paths in the Bible. One finds its end and destination there at the city of Babylon. And you're going to trace that city throughout Isaiah, all the way through the prophets, all the way through to Revelation. That is the end of one line. It is Babylon. It is destruction. It is those who trust in their performance and look to the ways of this world. And the other line finds its destination in the house of Abraham. Those who live and walk by faith and trust in God's promise. Friend, which will it be for you? And which will it be for us as a congregation? Let's pray.